This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sitterick. It's Friday, so we're going to jump right into our week in review. We had planned to start with the president's new immigration plan, but as of a couple minutes ago, we have a breaking news story. The Encore Boston Harbor Casino in Everett could be up for sale. MGM Resorts and the casino's owner, Wynn Resorts, just released a joint statement saying in part, quote, "Over the past several weeks, we have engaged in conversations around the potential sale of Encore Boston Harbor. They are very preliminary and of the nature that publicly traded corporations like ours often engage in. And in fact, when opportunities such as this are presented, we are required to explore. We cannot say today where these conversations will lead. However, we can reaffirm our commitment to the communities where we operate today." So, what does it all mean? We bring in our weekend review panelists, Shira Center, political editor at the Boston Globe. Shira, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
And Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist, political writer. Welcome back to you as well.
Good to be back.
So let me get your initial reactions. This story literally just breaking a couple minutes ago. What do you make of this news?
Yeah, well, I think it's notable that there's a prohibition against having more than one having a company holding more than one Massachusetts license. So the immediate question is, what does this mean for Springfield?
Right.
Right?
Which MGM currently owns.
Exactly, right. And what a shot in the arm to the local economy that casino brought. Well, what does it mean if they end up going through with the sale? My other thought is just generally about the service jobs. A lot of workers have signed up to work at the Encore. Some people have given notice to their current employers. They say it won't be delayed, but a lot of these people might not know who their boss is in 3 to 4 months.
Ed, what do you make of all this?
Well, it's just hard to believe, but all this began because a powerful man mistreated women. I just hope that this is a lesson for the other men in the state that the odds are not in your favor if you treat women this way. So I think it's just breathtaking to look back and see how this all fell apart.
Yeah, and obviously any potential move or sale would have to be approved by the Gaming Commission. What are you guys going to be watching for as the story develops?
I'll be watching to see, first of all, if Wynn's going to end up appealing the $35 million fine in the end. I think that'll tell us a lot about how committed they are to this.
Right.
I'll be watching. I think state legislators out from the Springfield area, I think they're going to get very nervous about the prohibition against owning more than one casino. I think everybody wants these products to come forward. I imagine they're probably going to be huddling right now to say, what do we do about this?
All right, so let's get back to what we had planned to open with, immigration. This week, President Donald Trump unveiled his latest plan on immigration.
Our proposal builds upon our nation's rich history of immigration while strengthening the bonds of citizenship that bind us together as a national family.
And so this plan, at least according to the president, would do two main things.
First, it stops illegal immigration and fully secures the border. And second, it establishes a new legal immigration system that protects American wages, promotes American values, and attracts the best and brightest from all around the world.
So this plan would prioritize visas for applicants with extraordinary talent, professional or specialized vocations, and exceptional students. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called the plan dead on arrival and has a real problem in general with the idea of merit-based immigration.
They're saying family is without merit. Are they saying most of the people who have ever come to the United States in the history of our country are without merit because they don't have an engineering degree?
So, Shira, Ed, this plan lacks some details, but what can it tell us about this administration's policies? What do you make of this new immigration plan?
So the thing that really occurred to me when I was reading the baseline bullet points of this plan is, what does this really get Trump, right, by putting this out there? He has to know it would be dead on arrival, first of all, because it includes the wall, right? Congressional Democrats are never going to go for that. And it doesn't deal with the 11 million current immigrants here who are undocumented, which is going to be a non-starter for even some Republicans in the Senate. So where does this get Trump? I think it gets Trump the ability to say, oh, I tried again, and oh, I tried again about the wall, because in the end, it's not probably not going to go very far.
Ed, what's your initial reaction?
Well, of course, I don't think the public supports building a wall. I don't think that would stop illegal immigration, even if they did so. I also think that maybe that people don't understand that the people in the family and diversity lottery systems are actually pretty well educated. Kind of this broad misunderstanding about, you know, who's coming to this country, you know, under what programs. People who come here illegally and through asylum are poorly educated. People who are brought in by employers are actually quite educated. People who come into the family and diversity lottery system are even more educated than the average American. So this might not have the effect that President Trump thinks it's going to have, because the people who come into the existing program are actually quite educated. I'm against the idea of merit. I don't think my great-grandfather had merit. I'm trying to have merit here as a citizen. I don't think that should be the basis of immigration policy. However, Canada does have this system. They have a system where they prefer skilled workers, and it's working up there fine. Canada's not a terrible place in terms of their immigration policy. So I do think we should take a step back and, instead of criticizing this plan for what it isn't, think a bit more about, you know, what does skilled immigration mean, and are we automatically against it? I don't think we should be.
Yeah, Shira, let me have you respond to that, because Nancy Pelosi takes a pretty strong stance against merit-based immigration. Is that a mistake for Democrats? We obviously can't let everybody in. Isn't there an argument to be made for incentivizing certain attributes?
I think it's an important discussion to have in the context of the greater immigration debate. I don't think it's the greatest problem in the current immigration debate. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's not been welcomed so heartily. One of the things about the merit-based system, too, that always surprises me is what that does, too, to local markets, right? We're in an economy where we need people in service jobs, theoretically, right? These are not people who would get in necessarily on merit-based immigration passes. So I think we have to think, too, about the broader economy and what a system like that would do to the cost of living in a lot of major metropolitan areas.
It's really interesting, Shira. You mentioned that even some Republicans have pushed back vocally against this. Senator Lindsey Graham, one of President Trump's most vocal supporters in the Senate, said that he doesn't think this is going anywhere via legislation. He did say something interesting on Wednesday before this was unveiled, that whatever gets passed has to have some bipartisan buy-in.
Now, here's what I did tell him. You're going to have to get Democrats in the room. And this is the time for the Tuesday Trump to show up. This is the guy that got us all in a room saying, I'm going to work with you to solve this problem in a humane fashion and make sure we don't repeat it for the next president.
So on the one hand, admitting we need Democrats to work with us on this problem. On the other hand, this plan that President Trump just unveiled has been criticized by some on the more conservative side. NPR talked to Mark Krikorian, the executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, who said, quote, if it's real legislation, why would they start with what's already a compromise position? So there are folks on the right who say this doesn't do enough. It doesn't curtail legal immigration numbers. So it seems to be this kind of middle of the road plan that doesn't make anybody happy. Is there any possible solution that everybody can work together on here?
Oy, you know, you just have these outlying factors that are so important to the right and the left. First of all, the current immigration levels, which this proposal doesn't change at all, right? That's a no-go on the far right. You have the wall, that's a no-go on the left, and I think in the center for a lot of people, too. It's just, you'd really have to chip it off piece by piece. I think that's maybe the only way to tackle it.
Yeah, and especially once you start to pile up those no-goes, as you said. Another no-go for Democrats has been not dealing with DACA recipients, mm-hmm. the so-called Dreamers. But Ed, I'm wondering, are Democrats making a mistake by saying we're not going to come to the table unless we see X, Y, or Z? Trump has used this as an attack against the party before.
I think they should come to the table. I know it's hard because the president has signaled many false things about immigration. He signaled that he would be happy to support the Dreamers. Republicans have made several false signals in the past few years on supporting Dreamers. They're not really going to do it. I think many Republicans want to vote for reasonable reforms, but the problem is the base doesn't want it. Trump's people don't want it. It will never get through any sort of legislative process. I don't believe there's some sort of grand bargain available right now. Republicans, unfortunately, are too angry. They love to talk about the first million people who came to America. They certainly don't like the last million people who came to America, even though they're more educated than the people who were here 200 years ago.
All right. Well, we're going to shift gears and talk about another pretty contentious issue that's shaping up to be a big part of the 2020 debate, and that's abortion. Missouri State House just passed this afternoon a bill already passed in the Senate that bans abortions after 8 weeks of pregnancy without exceptions. That now goes to the governor's desk. He said he supports it. Also this week, we saw Alabama's governor sign into law what's widely considered the most restrictive abortion law in the country. It makes performing an abortion a felony in almost all cases, punishable by up to life in prison. No exceptions for rape and incest. Georgia, Mississippi, Ohio have also passed laws effectively banning abortions as soon as a heartbeat is detectable. And even here in New England, we saw a Senate committee in Rhode Island reject a bill this week that would have codified the right to an abortion in state law. Here in Massachusetts, maybe unsurprisingly, we might go a different direction. The Roe Act is scheduled to be up for debate soon. That would expand abortion access. Here's Rebecca Hart Holder, executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Massachusetts, speaking to WBUR this morning.
We think it's an important moment for Massachusetts to make a stand and say that the Commonwealth supports reproductive freedom for women, and we simply won't tolerate laws that harm gender equality.
Okay, so your reaction to this on a local and national scale?
So if you would have asked me in late November 2016 if I thought abortion might be Trump's lasting legacy or one of the main prongs of his lasting legacy in American politics, I would have looked at you like you were crazy. But it's amazing what's happened here, right? Because so many Trump supporters came in on these waves, and the current political divide has enabled a lot of far-right politicians in some of these states to pass these laws. And between that and what's gone in the courts and the number of judicial nominees that have been approved, plus the reshaping of the Supreme Court under Trump, all of those factors together have created a place where this can happen. And the great irony for me is Trump was never – it's a bit of a long shot to call him a pro-life evangelical.
To be fair, though, he did tell in one of the presidential debates, he said, I will appoint justices who want to overturn Roe v. Wade, and it will happen automatically. So it's not as if there was no warning that this could be coming. Ed, what do you make of all this?
Donald Trump's number one task seems to be to placate the Republicans who support him. And the Republican Party is a huge component in it that is very pro-life, and they demand these things. So I think that he has consistently tried to give the Republican base what it wants, and this is another example of that. As far as the other states, I'm glad to see state politics matters, that in a time of broken national politics, that state governments can do things. I think in this state, it's different because we have a Republican governor who is pro-choice but is not sure about some of the things in the bill being proposed. And so I think we'll actually get a debate on this than having it be rushed through as we've seen in other states where one party controlled the governorship and the legislature. So I'm hoping we have a better quality debate here. I don't support the latest bill, but I do think that we're going to get a good debate on it, and I'm looking forward to it.
So, yeah, go ahead, Sure.
I would say the effect of this is rather fascinating because you essentially have the beginnings of what would happen if they did overturn Roe v. Wade, which is a state-by-state system, and you're getting an incredible abortion divide where Massachusetts and other states in New England or
more
liberal states, New York, right, become essentially havens for this.
Right.
Right? And Stephanie Ebert had a great story in today's Globe about this, that people in Massachusetts – oh, are we about to get there? I don't want to –
No. Sorry.
No,
she's the Globe political editor.
It's a great story. I didn't edit it. It's a great story about how people in Massachusetts are volunteering to essentially become that haven for people. It's fascinating, the divide.
It's really interesting. In the Alabama case, I know one of the lead sponsors said of the bill, yeah, I know this is unconstitutional. That's the point. Basically admitting we want this to go up to the Supreme Court. What do you make of that strategy? Is there a chance this gets to the Supreme Court and Roe v. Wade potentially overturned?
I think there's a chance, right? How long will it take? What's the country's politics going to look like at that time? I think there's a chance. And I certainly think the pro-life movement sees this as a once-in-a-generation opportunity with the Supreme Court the way it is.
Yeah, I agree. But I do have faith in Chief Justice John Roberts. I think he cares very much about the image of the court. I think his wisdom in accepting cases and determining, you know, how they're debated will be a huge factor in all this, because if all these states agitate in this direction, the Supreme Court will have to address it. But I'm counting on the Chief Justice to decide how that's addressed in a way that maintains legitimacy of the court.
It's really interesting. I want to play one cut we have here from televangelist Pat Robertson on his TV show, The 700 Club. He actually said this week that he thinks Alabama went too far.
I think Alabama has gone too far. They've passed a law that would give a 99-year prison sentence to people who can commit abortion. There's no exception for rape or incest. It's an extreme law, and they want to challenge Roe versus Wade. But my humble view is that this is not the case we want to bring to the Supreme Court, because I think this one will lose.
So, Ed, I want to ask you, is this a smart move for your party? Do you think this is going to be a key issue in 2020, and is it a winning issue for Republicans?
It is a key issue for 2020. I think it unites most of the party around this. I think it'll be a great way to get people.
But you can't even get Pat Robertson on board.
Well, I know when you've lost Pat Robertson, you know, I guess you've lost evangelical America somehow with this. This is the only thing I think that they want right now is for this to pass. So I do think they'll make it the issue about this in 2020, saying we need a couple more justices to make sure this goes through. But maybe one of the only ways you can get lots of people to vote for Trump who really don't want to.
Sure. Any final thoughts on this issue?
No, I think we've covered it. Yeah.
All right. Well, I do want to note that Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, one of the number of Democrats running for president, has released a plan to protect abortion this morning. Through that, I want to jump into the 2020 race. You've got 1,000 Democrats running for president. How is this a good thing for the party?
I don't think it is at this point. We had, by our count, the 23rd and 24th candidates get in this week. That's Steve Bullock of Montana and New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. And it makes it such
Bill de Blasio.
Bill de Blasio. Oh, excuse me. Rewind a little bit there. Thank you. And it makes it such a free-for-all. But it has a real implications for the party, one of which is when you have so many people in the race, the party can't effectively do this soul-searching it does after it loses a presidential election to figure out the direction they want to go in. Are they a center, left-of-center party? Are they a far-left party? They can't do that when you have so many people because the field just doesn't winnow fast enough.
Ed, what do you make of the incredibly crowded Democratic field?
What a time of confusion in American politics. I can't imagine explaining this to somebody from another country about that this is the way in which this weird billion-dollar talent show we're having for the next year, people auditioning for who can be popular that week. I just think this is a terrible thing. Let's not forget that for the 2016 race on our side, we had like 17 candidates. And everyone initially said, well, Ed, you know, more competition is better. This will be great. And I said, are you sure? What are the rules going to be? Having this many people in the game, is that going to help us? And what happened? The people who said the most outrageous things got all the attention. It became a circus. And then a ringmaster stepped up and said, don't worry, I can handle the circus. So I think it's terrible. Terrible because people think that, more people will compete on these criteria. We'll get more quality, more ideas. I want to say you're going to unleash dynamics that you're not prepared for, and you could have chaos just like we did.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned circus. Lawrence Mayor Dan Rivera was tweeting that this is starting to look like a circus, and he said, at what point does the party say something? Maybe call Speaker Pelosi to get some direction. This will end poorly. And then he went after Seth Moulton specifically. Adults in the party need to say there is no reason a junior U.S. rep from Salem, Mass. Should be running when the senior senator from Mass. Has been for months, obviously referring to Senator Elizabeth Warren. Shira, what do you make of that?
Unexpected comment from the mayor of Lawrence. I think he does raise an interesting point, which is what is the party's role in something like this? And I think the Democratic Party does not want to touch this with a 10-foot pole. And especially given what happened last year with the DNC's favorable stance towards Clinton over Sanders. They want the party to play this out completely on its own. But Ed raises such a good point. Is this how Democrats end up with a nominee like a Marianne Williamson, right? Is that how this happens? Probably not.
Well, so far this week,
we said that too.
So far this week, the former Vice President Joe Biden has been leading the polls. He visited New Hampshire for the first time since officially entering the race.
This is the United States of America. Anything we've set our mind to, we have never failed to accomplish. I refuse to postpone any longer the possibilities for this country, and we have to end it now, this administration.
So that is a common theme that we've seen that's also polling as one of the most motivating factors for potential Democratic voters is who can beat President Donald Trump. Is Joe Biden the best guy to beat Trump?
That's a question for the voters of New Hampshire and Iowa to answer first. I think it's safe to say Biden has had a really strong start. I think there was a lot of chatter before he got in about could he meet the expectations that a lot of people had for his campaign. I think it's been a strong start, and the polls have shown that.
Ed, what do you think?
I think he's benefiting. He's the only person who's benefiting from the number of candidates in the race. The metaphor I like to use is that it's like walking into a restaurant and seeing a menu full of unfamiliar things, saying, "Oh my God, I'll have the hamburger." I don't want to think about all these other things. And I think that the average person doesn't want to do homework on 21 candidates. They say, "Oh, Biden, he's fine. Who's vice president? This will be okay," and they pick him. So I think he's actually benefiting from this huge field, and I think that's probably one of the reasons why he's doing so well.
Yeah, Shira, I know James Pindle was writing about the fact that all of this attention on the 2020 presidential race has really hurt the Democrats in their quest to retake the Senate. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that's a great point James made in his column this morning, that because you have so many candidates running for president, a lot of these people would be stellar Senate candidates. And Democrats, if they want to have any kind of a platform for which to accomplish things in a couple years, need to win the Senate. And they have a decent chance in a couple years.
All right. I want to make sure we have some time for our hubbubs here. So, Shira, let's start with you on that.
So this is not exclusive to the hub, but I thought it was an interesting story about the SAT adding an adversity score that rates students' hardships along with their SAT. Now, they're just rolling this out. And according to the New York Times, the score would be between 1 and 100, average student receiving a 50, and it's calculated using 15 factors, including the high school, the crime and poverty level of the student's neighborhood. Obviously, this would have an impact just given higher ed in the Boston area. My question is, The stores are not supposed to be reported to the students, only to college officials. How long till students really find out their scores, right? It's like your Uber score, right?
Right.
You know, I think it's only a matter of time till that somehow gets out and people are talking about it. And I think it's just opening up a firestorm of controversy.
All right, Ed, your turn.
So my hubbub is a little bit of a self-plug here, a little off the radar. So two nights ago, up on Beacon Hill, we had a big Beacon Hill politics chess tournament where 50 VIPs came and played and watched. It was very diverse. We had some state legislators. We had reporters, advocates, Republicans, Democrats, women, people of color, all different roles, pollsters coming together to play chess. We lost our two state senators because they got last-minute commitments. Our two state reps came. They were late because of a vote, but Representatives Cutler and Santiago played, and they were excellent. They had great skills, and everybody agreed that this growing chess tournament on Beacon Hill is going to be a place for everybody to come and work out differences and, you know, play against people that they oppose in the public square, and it's going really well every quarter, and it's growing all the time.
Who was the most surprising player you saw?
The most surprising player? Who would I say that would be? I think Stephanie Murray of Politico was there, and she learned to play chess for these events, and she was fantastic, and we really enjoyed watching her play.
All right, I love it. So for me, in lieu of a hubbub this week, I just want to take a minute here to recognize one of our talented and hardworking producers, Eve Zukoff. Eve's been with us on Radio Boston for about a year, and she has produced a ton of fantastic content for the show. She actually first started here at WBUR as an intern and as a BU fellow. She went on to work as a production assistant for Last Scene, the award-winning WBUR and Boston Globe podcast about the Gardner Museum heist. To that note, worth noting, I think part of that job actually required her to transcribe hours of undercover tape, including at one point at least 366 iterations of the F word. she's produced every kind of segment since joining Radio Boston, call-in segments, reporter debriefs, in-depth issue explainers, field pieces. And in fact, in June, she'll receive a Prindy Public Radio News Director's Award for her feature story on the Medfern Cemetery. That's up on our website, radioboston.org. You should definitely check that out. Not only did Eve produce high-quality segments for Radio Boston day in and day out, but she did it all with a positive, upbeat attitude, never backing down from a challenge. And there's truly no better call screener in the land. As she herself has said, it's one of the things she was born to do. She's moving on to tackle another new challenge. I have no doubt she's just getting started as a journalist. So thank you, Eve, for everything you've done for the show. We're really going to miss you, but we're also very, very excited to see what you'll be working on next. So Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer, thank you so much for your time and insight today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Shira Center, political editor at the Boston Globe, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, why are so many Game of Thrones fans upset with the final season? I'm one of them, I'll tell you. And I'm Chris Siderick. This is Radio Boston.